Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 51 of Pepperdine People. I'm Pete Peterson from the School of Public Policy, and I'm joined today by Bill Voegeli. Bill is a visiting scholar at the Salvatore Center at Claremont McKenna College and is also an editor at the Claremont Review of Books. He has a new article, a new essay out in the most recent issue of City Journal, and we're going to be speaking with him today on issues relating to federal and state expenditures. Bill, it's great to have you here.
It's good to be here, Pete.
Bill, I wonder if you could tell us first a little bit about the premise of your piece. And in the title of the essay, which is talking about anti-tax absolutism, to frame both the premise of what your piece is, but also why this movement or the discussion around keeping taxes low or anti-tax is being described as absolutism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, here's one way to sort of frame the premise of it. At a school of public policy, everyone remembers vividly Thomas O'Neill's adage that all politics is local. And of course, Speaker O'Neill was a partisan Democrat, a committed New Deal liberal. He had a 50-year career in American politics. He was first elected to the Massachusetts legislature in 1936. He retired from the United States Congress in 1986. So, he saw the whole string of the kind of middle of American history there. He was, when he said all politics is local, he was pushing back against Reaganism, a sort of dominant force at the end of his political career. And he was saying that the particular trumps the general. All politics is local means that people in their capacity, they think about what the government can do for their neighborhoods, their cities, their towns, even their families. And he hoped that by stipulating that he would continue the New Deal tradition of deciding the big question with reference to the small, that if people liked the long list of particular things the government was doing, they would be in favor of the entire package and be willing to pony up the money to make the entire package possible. It seems to me that that adage, that all politics is local, expresses in the 21st century more of a wish than an analysis. I think the dominant fact now is that all politics is fiscal, that we find it necessary to debate the particular things the government ought to be doing in the context of the broader question of how much we want the government to undertake and how much we want to pay for the government's programs. So when I write an article for City Journal on anti-tax absolutism, I'm saying that by holding the line and saying that the percentage of our gross domestic product going into the government doesn't need to be increased. Rather, the government needs to make better use of the money we're already giving them. The conservatives are not necessarily wanting to go back to the minimal night watchman state, but are forcing a necessary and valuable conversation. What really do we want the government to do, and how can it do it most effectively?
I think that's really one of the nuanced elements of your essay, which I think is so important, is that you're making an argument based on data, but what you're also saying is that part of the issue that we're facing here in the country is really one around public participation and rhetoric, in that a lot of the large government, small government, that whole paradigm of discussions that's supposedly happening around the country is not really being made in a legitimate way. That there's a discussion, particularly on the left, when we're looking at the role or the possible support for a larger government, that's really not transparent. And I wonder if you could talk about that element, that the argument around whether we as American citizens want a larger government or a smaller government is missing a piece related to cost. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you could talk to that.
Yeah, I think there's a funny way that the full price tag never becomes apparent until well after the ink is dry on the bill and the president has signed it and the program is up and running. The California High-Speed Rail Authority, I think, is a notorious but illuminating example of that. You maybe are old enough to remember, I'm sure I am, the situation comedy from the 60s, Gomer Pyle. Well, every time I read an article in the LA Times about this or that new revelation about the high-speed rail project, I think of Gomer Pyle because his catchphrase of the show was always, surprise, surprise. You know, they told us the thing would cost $45 billion for the whole system. And then it turns out, well, the land acquisition costs are really much higher than that. The amount that we have to budget for the maintenance is much more than originally appreciated. Surprise, surprise. This thing was a lot more expensive than we were initially led to believe. And I'm not, you know, it's hard to psychoanalyze. I think... We don't know yet, for example, how, assuming that it stays on the books and in force, how the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, will work out over the next 5 or 10 years. But it, too, seems to be based on some extraordinarily optimistic projections about how all of this is going to happen. The heart of the bill is the idea that this new entity, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, is going to be marvelously successful in discovering and implementing new efficiencies in the healthcare system, one that will radically cut down the amount of money that's being spent without diminishing the quality of healthcare being provided. And then maybe it will. You know, people do astonishing things that were not considered possible before. You can't rule it out simply because it hasn't happened or isn't likely. But it nevertheless, if a big, big, big solution were that easily grasped just by getting 15 or so experts together in a room to work hard and bear down on this stuff, you kind of think they would have done it by now.
Well, and I think, well, let me just say first, it might be important for the listener, if for those that might be outside of California, the initiative that passed the buying of bonds in 2008 for the California High-Speed Rail, it was originally proposed to the public to be between a $35 and $40 billion project. Just within the last 2 months, the California High-Speed Rail Authority itself has come out with revised numbers that put that closer to $100 billion. And so that's just within the space of 3 years that upward revision has happened. And I think one of the points that you make in the article, and I think what's so effective about your presentation is looking at history, the history of budget forecasts in major federal and state government programs does not give one confidence that something as massive as Obamacare is being adequately forecast. So everything from the social welfare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, some of these others, to things ranging through federal education programs, the original forecasts when the bill was passed don't even come close to where we're experiencing expenditures now.
If a handful of the programs that we were told would pay for themselves really did pay for themselves, our government at every level would be just drowning in money.
Right.
So, and I think, smart writer you probably read too, Clive Crook, who writes for The Atlantic.
Right,
and,
yes.
Now, I think Bloomberg as well, I think. He favored Obamacare. He thought that our country needed a program like that and that it was disgraceful that health insurance was as dicey and precarious as it was in this country. But even this fellow, who believed the program to be a good thing, thought the way it was sold to the American public was shameful. He wrote a column or a blog post right after the legislation was passed and signed in 2010, this would have been,
right,
saying that the claim put forward enthusiastically, front and center, by President Obama and then Speaker Pelosi, that the new health care law was first and foremost a way of containing health care costs. He said it was an insult to the intelligence. I think that's right.
Well, and tracking along with that, another one of those promises seems to be, and this doesn't just come from the current White House, it was a promise, as you had discussed, by then candidate Kerry in 2004 and then candidate Hillary Clinton in the 2008 race, was this mythical $200,000 a year or $250,000 a year barrier that if you raise taxes just on that small percentage of Americans who are making as a household more than that, that somehow that would be the pixie dust that would solve our budget problems. And so I wonder if you could speak more specifically to what the numbers, how those numbers actually pencil out. Yeah. If we were to, in fact, keep tax rates of what they are, expending what they are for those below $250,000, but then to raise them above.
Yeah. Some folks at the Tax Policy Center worked through that stuff a year ago. They published a report called Desperately Seeking Revenue, and I think I discussed it a little bit in the article, that said that if we really take this seriously, if we want to not balance the budget, but if we want to close federal deficits by towards the end of this decade to 2% of gross domestic product. And they picked that target on the theory that a 2% GDP deficit in a normal period of economic growth would mean that your total federal debt was starting to shrink as a percentage of GDP. So this would be, you know, you're at least kind of fighting things to a draw under these circumstances.
Right.
But that's still a lot of money, 2% of GDP. That's still a pretty big deficit.
Right.
But even to get that close to goal, you would have to, if there are going to be no tax increases whatsoever on anybody making less than $250,000 a year, then you have a top rate that goes from 35% to 91%. You have a capital gains rate that goes from 15% to 39%. You basically are back to the highest tax rates that this country has ever seen, to quote a line from Mickey Kaus, expecting Americans to tax like Northern Europeans. That's like asking us to cook pasta like Italians or play cricket like Englishmen. This is just not
our way.
Yeah, this is not a promising venture to which to commit the society. And so if that's not feasible, if the money simply isn't there, then you have to say, well, either we're going to curtail what the government does, or we're going to demand tax increases from a much wider portion of the American income distribution.
As we come to a close, I think one of the real effective things about your writing, not only in this piece, which is, again, not a penny more in the current issue of City Journal, but in your excellent book, Never Enough, which I highly recommend to the listeners, which takes a much more extensive and historical view of spending and revenues in the United States. What can be done? I mean, are there at least one or two things that we should be thinking about either structurally or rhetorically as we talk about these issues? Because especially here in 2012, this big government, small government, what size of government do we want seems to be the principal battlefield, if I can use that, rhetorical battlefield in which this election will be fought.
Well, I think that more specifically, really the terms of the debate are going to be set by the Republican embrace of and Democratic rejection of the framework advanced by Representative Paul Ryan. I think the most important thing about beyond the details of the plans that Ryan has in mind, the most important thing is that he says, historically, federal taxes have been about 18% of GDP in America. If we like that, if we're comfortable with that, if we want to keep that, here's the kind of welfare state you're going to have. Here's the kind of welfare state you have to have. If you want a different one, a bigger, thicker, more Scandinavian type one, then you have to blow way, way past the 18% GDP limit. You need another 5, 10, 15 GDP points to sort of get that stuff right. If the American people are prepared to sign off on that, then that's what they're going to get. But if they're not, they have to make it clear. The alternatives are either a streamlined, differently structured welfare state or massive Greeks-level government indebtedness.
Mm. Some very important options and alternatives, and I think, Bill, what's so important about your article in the current City Journal and also in your book, Never Enough, is while you certainly have your opinions, and I think they're legitimate, what's more important is that as a country, we have legitimate discussions about where we want to go. And oftentimes that needs to move beyond the level of rhetoric to connect rhetoric to actual numbers and see, is this a direction where we want to go, as opposed to kind of being sold into things, much like, I think it's so important you raise that example of high-speed rail. It's just, I don't think there's a chance, given the numbers that we're seeing now, that if the numbers that we know now, as far as the expenses for high-speed rail were proposed 3 years ago, I don't think there's a chance in the world that that would have been passed.
It barely...
As it was.
With less than 53% of the votes. So you could easily peel off 5, 10, 50% of those votes if... It's, oh, by the way, it's going to cost $100 billion, maybe more. We'll see. No, never, never.
So we have to continue, I think, to have that perspective for all these so-called larger, massive government programs. So, Bill, it's great to have you here. This, again, is Pete Peterson for Pepperdine People with Bill Voegeli.